Okay, welcome. And this Mike Wilbur and Tom Shan from the drawing board to the apparatus floor with the apparatus architects. We're here down in Baltimore at the Firehouse Expo 2006. And today we're going to cover some topics, some things that have come up here in the last few days with the some of the classes that Michael and I have taught. We've got our little Mike and Tom rundown. We're going to cover, not necessarily in order, quints, pumps on trucks. I know that right away for those people who listened to the first episode. We may need to get Medic 10 over here from the Baltimore City Fire Department. Between quints and pumps on trucks, Brother Mike may not be feeling very well here in a little bit. We are then going to cover some things that have come up, questions and email questions on warranty issues on apparatus. We'll have a couple of responses back to some emails from questions that have come in from folks as a result of the first podcast, and then to the folks out here in the audience, we'll cover a general Q&A for anything and everything that you may want to throw at us.
Speaking to the email, we would like to have some more questions. We did good after the last podcast. We'd like to have some more. Just write in to the apparatus architect at firehouse.com, and you will get your questions answered on the air during our next podcast.
Last couple days, Michael and I were teaching down at the Anne Arundel County Training Academy, doing hands-on training on behalf of Firehouse at the Expo. And in the two classes, we had a number of departments represented that operated quints. And while it's probably yet to be determined whether it's they're good or bad, it seemed that much of the feedback that we were getting from folks, including some departments that were represented from the state of Colorado, which is kind of interesting, is that after they're purchased, they maybe present some more operational issues. The buying, the specking of the rig, the placing it in service is just one issue. They've had the innumerable issues of trying to keep rigs in service. So to that point, we want to talk about a few things specifically about quints. Just because you own a quint doesn't mean that you can't have sufficient ground ladders on your other arriving apparatus that is going to be coming in at the scene of the fire. This particular jurisdiction was a rapidly developing city, had four stations, had originally purchased two quints, and had some significant difficulties in trying to mechanically keeping them both in service on any given day. The one unit, which was the larger, I think they said it was 105, 110 foot ladder, large tandem axle unit, had so many problems that when a new chief took over in this career fire department, he made the decision that rather than have the quint deployed at a centrally located station that would enable the unit to go north-south in this city with a reasonable response time, they put it way up in the northern corner in the slower station.
They
hid it from general use, right? With the thought being that if we put it in a slow company, maybe we can actually keep this thing on the street. Well, that might be great from the mechanical standpoint. It creates a great operational impediment in that, according to the folks from this department, they now had 15 and 20 minute responses routinely for the first due, the only due vehicle equipped with an aerial ladder in the community. That's one issue. And who created that? Well, that's kind of like the fire department. Many times with apparatus design, or if we have a specification issue, we're trying to evaluate a piece of apparatus for acceptance before we cut the check to accept it, and there's a problem, we're looking for somebody to blame. Was it the builder? Was it the people who wrote the specs? Did somebody misinterpret things improperly? In this particular case, or what was very enlightening to Brother Mike and myself the last 2 days, some of these issues that came up with the quint apparatus were things we brought this on ourselves. We spec them, we purchased them, go to put them in service, and now we're not sure how the heck to deploy it or how to use it. The B part of this, which was even more interesting, they're telling us about the types of structures that they're typically building in this community, 2.5 to 3 stories on the front, but because of topography, you come around in the back, now you got a full 4-story building. Every one of their engine companies was equipped with the 1901 standard ground ladder complement of a 10-foot folding ladder, 14-foot roof ladder, and then a 24-foot extension ladder. So they would routinely run calls to these buildings and not even have enough ladders if they amassed all three engines to show up prior to the arrival of the quint. They can't even safely ladder the building. So once again, who brought that on? Ourselves. You know, somebody in that organization decided they go to buy a pumper, they're going to buy it with the standard ladders, and nobody asked the question, is a 24-foot ladder going to work for us today? And it clearly wasn't in this department, with a lot of frustration from the fellows who actually operate these rigs to realize when we show up to Mrs. Smith's house, and if Mrs. Smith doesn't walk out the front door or present herself on side A or side one of the building, Mrs. Smith decides to go out the back of the building, Mrs. Smith is going to be taking a tumble because we don't have ladders to be able to reach her.
Quints are an interesting issue. We talk about safety all the time, and they create some safety concerns. And the safety concern is this. If you have a quint apparatus going to a row of stores, or more often you'll have a typical engine and a typical ladder apparatus, and they have a row of stores on fire. And I'll take somebody in the class and say, okay, you're the engine firefighter. You're riding with your back to the officer. You're going to have the nozzle on this fire. What is your size up like? And we talk about, well, what size hose? In my department, in the New York City Fire Department, for a commercial building fire, we lead off with 2.5-inch hose. Some departments that are undermanned and understaffed may lead off with 1¾-inch hose. So we figure out what kind of hose. Maybe it's a well-advanced fire on our arrival, and we're going to use the deck pipe, the large caliber stream on the engine. We want to know if the building is equipped with sprinklers or standpipes. Okay, maybe we're taking a Clemens bag in with some fold-ups or roll-ups into this building and stretching off a standpipe. Is the building sprinklered? Without, we would then have to augment the sprinkler system with some kind of large diameter line to help feed the sprinklers and the standpipes. So that's a pretty comprehensive engine size up for a row of stores that are on fire. We go over to the truck side and we say, geez, truck firefighter, you're riding with your back to the officer, you're first due at this row of stores, what are you going to do? What's your size up like? And we know that size up starts once you receive the alarm. So as you're riding in the truck, you are thinking about these issues. And of course, for a truck firefighter riding in a ladder company, that particular firefighter is thinking about ventilation and entry and search, forcible entry and search. Well, you look at that size up, and then you look at an engine size up, and then you put these firefighters on quints. What gets done, what doesn't get done, who does what? There have been a couple of cases in point where most jurisdictions can't properly man quints to do both jobs. So then when they show up with a quint apparatus, we have to choose whether we want to be an engine or a truck. And if you go back to the culture of the fire service and firefighters, we get our excitement and our adrenaline from stretching hose lines and putting fires out. So the reality is, in a high percentage, 90%+ of time, the folks with quint apparatus generally operate them as just very expensive engine companies because the hose lines get stretched and the vital truck work that needs to be done at the scene of this fire is simply not being done, or it's getting done so late in the fire that it really is kind of pretty worthless at that point in the fire. And so that's, some jurisdictions use quints and they train for them and they properly man them and they're used with a great deal of success. But they seem to be in the minority and not the majority. Most folks that have quints don't have enough people on them and are not necessarily properly trained in their use.
Based on some of the questions I got during the hands-on portion, ranging from that department in Colorado with 4 stations, it's a career department, and growing to a gentleman that was in the class from a central New Jersey department that doesn't own any kind of aerial equipment, has a quint on order, it's going to be delivered in the fall, and now they're kind of figuring out, like, how are they going to deploy it? Are they going to run it first or second? If you look at it in the volunteer service, it's even more important to have a defined plan, not just to go buy the rig. And I can say this, in my 34-year career in the fire service, it's all been spent in volunteer organizations. What do we typically do? Elect our staff and at least our chief officers every year. So in this particular case, it was a prior chief and a prior administration that purchased the rig. There's going to be a new incoming chief that's going to decide how to deploy it. It needs to be things that need to be a little bit more well planned out. And with that, one of the questions that came in via email from a gentleman, Tom B., up in the town of Guilderland, which I'm pretty sure is outside the city of Albany in New York. And this is pretty typical. Our department has just started a new apparatus committee to replace a 1979 pumper. A lot of people are of the opinion that we need a quint. What are the considerations that we need to address as far as size, mid or rear mount, and ISO ratings? My concern is this decision may be made based on opinion rather than facts. Pretty poignant email. If you have a department that has never owned a piece of aerial apparatus at all, one of the things that continues to amaze at least myself and Mike is why people automatically gravitate to say, we're going to buy a ladder truck, we're going to buy a Quint. I think there's a couple of reasons for that. One is it kind of makes you feel good. If you buy a Quint, you've put a little bit of everything together, all right? And our next article coming out in Firehouse in the Apparatus Architect series is talking about rescue pumpers or rescue engines. It's kind of like on the engine company side of the house, it's like the Quint operations of how that would work over on an engine, because we're taking a couple of different things, throwing them together. One of the other things that Mike kind of pointed out, and sometimes it was a little bit painful, saying, well, if you buy a Quint, and you buy a 100-foot Quint, and you put a 2,000 GPM pump on there and a 500-gallon water tank, we'll worry about the ground ladders later and some hose. What have we done? If we bought the biggest that we can in all the different assorted categories, we're kind of hoping nobody's ever going to come back on us and say, well, you did something wrong, because we bought the biggest thing we could, the biggest thing that would fit the firehouse, biggest thing maybe that the municipality or that the fire company could afford.
Well, we did the one consulting job there, and it was almost like those folks bought the apparatus. They ordered the apparatus, they bought, or they were in the process of buying a truck that was bought out of intimidation, because we started asking them questions. Well, why did you buy a 100-foot rear mount tower? Well, it was the biggest they made. Okay, well then, why did you buy a 2,000-gallon pump? It's the biggest we could get. I said, well, we were driving along and we went past the Home Depot, and it was a hydrant. And we said, well, how much water can you get out of the hydrant? Guy, well, this is, I don't know. So you're going to buy a 2,000-gallon pump, and you don't even know if the water supply on this particular street in this particular jurisdiction can feed the pump. Well, we don't want somebody to come back after us in 10 years and say, it doesn't work, or it was too short, or it didn't do something. So we just went out almost out of intimidation and bought the biggest and largest that it could be, and then we try to fit it in a station and drive it in town, and a lot of times it just doesn't work.
Yeah, going beyond the apparatus, I think the bottom line with many of these issues are you need to have a defined plan for how you're going to deploy the unit, and that needs to be decided when you're developing the specs and when the unit's being built, not kind of waiting to T-minus 30 days and then hoping that somebody's magically going to come up with a plan. One of the most interesting comments from this one gentleman where they had a Quint on order was that they bought it, I'm not sure who the builder was, but they're building with a 300-gallon tank. So the comment was, well, the tank's kind of small enough, so I don't think the chief would want to run that out first. It'll kind of force us to run it out second. Now, if you're spending $500,000 to $600,000 of the taxpayers' money, whomever's money, we need to kind of do it a little bit more intelligently. And this also then relates down to the maintenance component. If you've bought a Quint, particularly with all the electronic interlocks, many of those safety features that are absolutely necessary and mandated by the standard or by the design of the vehicle, you need to make sure that whoever is doing your mechanical and maintenance work, they're tuned up and they've got a good couple of days of training under their belt to be able to keep this unit in service. To go back to the department in Colorado, they realized this unit was somewhat problematic because it was the first or second unit that that particular builder had built. So I guess one of Tom and Mike's 100 undeniable truths of life is, and this goes for anyone, I work in the apparatus industry and I'll take the hit, you don't want to buy the first 5, 6, maybe even 10 of anything that somebody builds. If somebody comes out, and there might be somebody down on the display floor that has the new improved hydrant wrench, wait till they build a dozen of them. You guys buy the second dozen. When we get electronic components or a lot of other things, and particularly an aerial device where you're only probably going to buy one or two of those in your entire career, and we expect it to last 12, 15, 20 years, this rig that these folks had, I think, Mike, they said it was a 95 or 96. They can barely keep the thing in service. It's like a public embarrassment. The quote from the fellow who operated it said, if we could unload it and sell it today and convince the chief to do it, it'd be out of here on a flatbed tonight. That's not exactly a glowing endorsement of not necessarily knocking the Quints, but saying that's the only rig they've got in the whole town that can get them higher than 24 feet. And if you've got 3 and 4 story buildings, the attitude of that guy that drives it, who doesn't even have the confidence in the unit itself, we're not off on a very, very firm ground.
And we feel so strongly about this. Don't make your department the research and development arm for a manufacturer, because you will end up with a ton of headaches, and you will end up very disappointed, and you will end up almost frustrated beyond belief. Okay? Let somebody else do that. My mark is 50. Okay? Build 50 of them over a few years and come back and see us, and then we'll talk about it and see how it holds up over time. And there's a lot of things that are transpiring now. In this industry, you can go to anybody's website that builds fire trucks and find out that they're having some kind of electronic or electrical problems. The industry has been overwhelmed with electronics. The reality is that the same people that make $10 or $15 or $20 an hour putting fire trucks together and have been doing it for the past 30 years started out doing it with wrenches, torches, and welding stuff, and now end up having a lot of that being wiring and computers and computer knowledge and things like that. And so the business has just transformed rapidly to the point where the 1901 standard, which used to be revised every 5 years, has now been updated and continues to be updated every 3 years, just because of the technological advances and electronics that are present in the machines.
If your department's looking at buying, this kind of applies to any kind of apparatus, but particularly something that might be unique, where you only have one of these in the fleet, directly proportional to any kind of aerial ladder truck or quint. Most manufacturers have demonstrator units. That's what they use as a sales tool or technique to be able to show on the display floor, like there are some down here in Baltimore, be able to bring to your community so you can actually operate it at the ramp of your fire station. To go one step further beyond that, if you're thinking, for example, that you want to buy a tandem axle 100-foot quint and you're replacing a 70s vintage mid-mount device of some description, you want to have that manufacturer bring that to your community. And typically, the party line will be, Chief, Lieutenant, where do you have a parking lot? Oh, because we don't want to block your ramp in case you get a run. Where do you have a parking lot that we can go set this up in, all right?
And then what do you tell them? In my 30 years experience in the fire service, I never seen a parking lot catch on fire, okay? We may have created a few parking lots in our day, but I never saw a parking lot fire. So, Mr. Salesperson, I want you to take your truck down to Main Street and make it work for me. Don't let them off the hook by letting them take you to a parking lot.
You know, in some cases, because of liability, they cannot have you folks physically drive the rig. Some cases certainly want to ask that, all right? But you don't want to take it to a parking lot, all right? You want to be able to take it and drive it around through past the areas where you have target hazards and then physically set the vehicle up there, all right? Several years ago, I had the good fortune of working with a department that was buying a mid-mount tower that was replacing about a 22-year-old mid-mount tower. And experienced just what Mike said. We had a couple different vendors come in. First question is, where do you have a parking lot? Well, I wasn't there at the very start of the first demo, and as I'm driving from home, I see this aerial device up in the air, and where are we? We're in the middle of the community college parking lot, right? Well, that was great. We learned how to set it up, how the stabilizers worked, a few of the neat little tricks and features, but then after we got done with that, and they were ready to pack up to go back to the firehouse, I go, hey, time out. I said, here's what we want to do. We're going to go down to this little apartment complex where we had some target hazards. It was the middle of the day, so there's not too many cars in a parking lot. And I made sure the chiefs drove down individually in their chief's buggies, and we had a couple guys drive their POVs down there. Then we positioned the cars in the parking lot and got it jammed up, all right, like it would be at 2 o'clock in the morning, brought the tower down there and say, now let's set it up. Let's see what happens if we got a short jack. Let's see if this operationally is going to do what we need to do. And you could tell right away that individual demonstrating the rig, he'd never really been presented with that particular kind of challenge. And not this is bad, but understand, all right, that most of the people, particularly the folks that are on the road, somewhat, you know, road warriors in their world, going out to demonstrate these rigs and operate, they're very competent, very capable. If something shuts down, they can figure out how to get the thing back and running. Not that this is a bad thing, but these folks have not been firefighters and don't know some of the conditions and the constraints that we have to work with. So in my situation, if that parking lot at the community college had ever burned at 2 o'clock in the afternoon on a sunny day, we would have been home free. We could have set that vehicle up. Unfortunately, where we're going to have to set it up and try to make the roof and short jack on one side and jam one of the stabilizers between two parked cars is in an apartment complex. That's what makes or breaks here when things happen.
I'd like to spend a few minutes on warranty issues. Again, with the problems that the manufacturers are having with electronics and everything else, we come to warranty issues. Most manufacturers have a one-year warranty. I was on the apparatus committee in the city of New York where we purchased a five-year bumper-to-bumper warranty. Our mechanics did not touch the truck for its first 5 years of life except for preventive maintenance and light maintenance. Anything that went wrong with the truck went back to the vendor, or a vendor sent mechanics in to fix the apparatus. I was a chauffeur, a driver in 56 truck, where I was a fireman, and all of a sudden the ladder broke and it started spinning around and it lost this bull gear, it was called. And the apparatus was out of service for 5 months. So I went to the next apparatus committee meeting, and of course, it was interesting because we had some chiefs, we had Office of Management and Budget, we had an actuary there, all these smart folks. You know, just a fireman from the Bronx. And I asked the question. I said, are we getting the money back for the out-of-service time of the vehicle? Well, what do you mean? Well, I said, we spent huge sums of money paying for a five-year warranty, and now this truck is out of service for 5 months. And the vendor really has no reason to return it to us because every day that it's out of service, they're making money by not having to fulfill the warranty. And I got thinking and said, holy guacamole, I think he's onto something. My own volunteer department is going through some of the same issues now. They were distraught because they have a year warranty. The unit has been out of service twice for a total of 6 weeks. And I said to them, you ought to go back to the manufacturer and the vendor that sold it to you and say, hey, I want 6 more weeks. Because you did not warranty when it was sitting, the warranty is for when I have it and when it's in service. Tom can speak more to the verbiage as far as the contract language, but it may be something that if you're going to buy new apparatus that you want to address. In that you want to make it clear before you sign contracts and before you award a bid exactly what the warranty is and what happens if your unit is out of service for an extended period of time. Is the warranty then going to carry over past the calendar year because you did not have it in service and it was out for repairs? And the language on that is?
Most all of the major manufacturers have printed, as they refer to it, statements of warranty. They are typically included with the bid package, all right? So if you sign up for a fire truck, they'll have little one or two liners that says, for example, a standard warranty to be compliant with NFPA 1901 is 1 year bumper to bumper. In order to be competitive in the marketplace, most people offer extended warranties, and it's kind of like getting an extended warranty on your car. You can get it past, you know, 3 years, 36,000 miles, but you got to pony up a little bit of money for that. Cabs and structural work on the body are typically warranted for 10 years, although there are periods that will extend beyond that. Water tanks, frame rails, frame cross members, things like that typically are lifetime. But every one of those components has a separate little statement of warranty, which, as the proverbial fine print, tells you what it covers and, more importantly, what it does not cover. There's no warranty in the fire apparatus market that I'm aware of now that covers what Michael was referring to as out of service time. That would be something that you would have to develop and put up in your bid boilerplate. And for example, something that might be reasonable to say, if the vehicle is out of service for more than either X continuous hours, 72 or 96, or X number of days, that time will be added on at the end of the warranty period to extend it for times when the vehicle is legitimately out of service and in the hands of the manufacturer service representative to fix it, to get it operating to your satisfaction. Now, Mike's situation that he had with a bull gear, you know, going out, that period of time may, to some people, seem to be excessive. Dinner conversation last night that we had with one of the assistant chiefs from a local station down in Prince George's County, Maryland, that has a 10, 11-year-old unit that the hydraulic swivel went bad. And they're saying the rig's going to be out of service for 4 months. Well, the unit's clearly beyond the warranty period, but there are some components that you have to understand. Unlike, I take my personal vehicle into the local Toyota dealer and he says, Mr. Shand, I'm making this up, you need brakes. I'm not sitting there saying, geez, do I need to get the courtesy shuttle home, you know, because it's going to be fixed a week from Tuesday. He may have to send his runner, parts runner out to go get the parts, but 4 o'clock that afternoon, I'm going to drive home in my Toyota with a bill for $500, and he had the parts. Understanding with fire trucks and all of the different parts that are on there, there's a lot of these parts that are not even stock parts. They're parts that you're going to place an order into somebody, and that vendor is going to go build that part for you. There's only, surprisingly to this particular issue of hydraulic swivels, there's only one or two component vendors that supply that to everybody who builds an aerial device, and that's not a stock item. So you're going to put in an order, it's kind of like a pizza pie, but you don't get it 22 minutes later. You know, my local pizza outlet, no matter what time of the day or night you tell them, it could be Super Bowl Sunday, the standard answer is 22 minutes. Well, you know, on that day they're lying to you, all right? It's not going to really be 22 minutes. You know, it'll be 122 minutes, all right? But with some of these components, it takes a while to do it. So Michael has a good point on the warranty. That's something that you need to bring up and put into your boilerplate. It frankly is going to be something to be very difficult to negotiate during the contract time. So you want to kind of have the rules of engagement laid out out in the beginning there.
Oh, and you mentioned about the extended warranty. What can we tell folks about that? Is that a good thing, a bad thing? Does it depend on the vendor? How much generally does that run, and how can we extend the warranty?
Right. Most all of the builders will have warranties that can be extended out to a period of 5 years, incremented in 1 year periods. Now, how much does it cost? It's going to vary depending on what kind of rig you buy. A pumper or a rescue truck, you may be looking at something in the area of $1,500 to maybe $2,000 per year to extend that. An aerial device is going to be cost incrementally a little bit more. Is it worth it? I guess it depends on how strong your maintenance program is and where you have to go get the vehicle maintained. Because of the intimate amount of electronics on units anymore, in a lot of cases, when I first came up the volunteer fire service, you know, outside of having to overhaul the pump or the engine, everything was done in-house. There was somebody in the fire company that typically by vocation was a mechanic. And when you had mechanically injected diesel engines and a lot of things short of yanking the pump down and rebuilding or repacking the pump, many of those things were done by folks in-house. In a lot of organizations now, we frankly don't have the time, or in some cases don't have the mechanical talent to do it. So every time the rig goes out of service, it's going out to the maintenance shop to be done. Now, if you're going out using a private vendor, this depends on where you are in the country. Where I happen to hail from out of western part of New York State, if you take your fire truck to a local shop that just does fire apparatus repair work, it's typically $75 to $80 an hour to have that done. And to some folks, that might seem to be a little high. If you go down to southern New York, into the Rockland, Westchester, or Long Island area, it can be upwards of $100 to $120 an hour. And again, that sounds to be somewhat astronomical. To put things in perspective, if something happens to your home computer and you got to get one of the computer geek guys to show up, they're getting about $1.40 or $1.50 an hour. At my local automobile dealer where I take my car to get serviced, even to work on a car, it's $95 an hour. So doesn't take you too long for you to start to eat up that $1,500 to $2,000. Sounds like a heck of an expense. You probably only need one or two, you know, significant issues to go wrong after the initial warranty period, and to a point, it can pay for itself. So it's one of those things you can ask, but might be nice, so it can be clearly identified as an upfront cost. You put it as an option in the back of the bid and write in the language saying that you want to have an optional price to extend the warranty out to 2 years, 3 years, and 4 years, and have that price clearly identified. that enables you to be able to see what the value is, and then you can best judge based on what your annual operating costs are for that particular vehicle, whether it's, you know, significant and should be included.
Okay, we're going to go to another question from one of our listeners, and just want to urge our listeners, if you have a question and you want it answered on air by the apparatus architects, you can go online to apparatusarchitects@firehouse.com and get your questions answered in an upcoming podcast. What do we have, Tom?
All right, this one came in from a George F., and he says, I have two questions I'd like to solicit your input on. First, disc brakes or drum brakes? All right, well, let's cover a couple of things, rules of the road, of when you can and can't use those. With a lot of the heavier apparatus in a single axle application, you can put disc brakes on the front axle without any kind of limitation, no matter what the GVW rating on that particular component is. On a rear axle, you can use disc brakes up to 24,900 pounds. When you get above that, you get to a 27,000 pound axle or a 31,000 pound, you have to go to drum brakes. Disc brakes don't.
And then when you go to a tandem, right, we go 48,000, you can go disc, and then when you go up to over 48, we have to go to drums?
Then it's kind of packaged, and it depends upon the kind of suspension you're packaging with and whether you're using automatic snow ice chains, which is fairly common in certain areas. So then it's kind of becomes a mix and match issue. The disc brakes typically will have a better braking performance and will give you a shorter stopping distance. Will also generally provide you with a little bit better, if you have very long runs or runs where you're on the brakes a lot, will tend to have a little bit better heat rejection off the brake and less what they would refer to as brake fade. So there are a couple of considerations there. Disc brakes, again, depending upon manufacturer, they are going to be more expensive than drum brakes, and typically it's an option or an upgrade. If it's, again, the kind of thing that you're considering, but you're in somewhat of a money pinch or money situation, you can put that in as an option at the back of the spec. Obviously, the drum brakes are going to come as standard, and you can option out the disc brakes to see and identify what the cost of that's going to be, because I guess parallel there would be like saying you're going to want to go buy cornflakes. We can buy the standard store brand cornflakes. Then if you want the real deal, the Kellogg stuff, that can be another $2 more a box just for that. Different people are going to charge different prices for the disc brakes over the drum.
And another thing with disc brakes as well, in the New York City Fire Department, we went from rotor standard brakes to disc brakes, and one of the benefits that we gained was the less downtime. It takes our mechanics a couple of hours to change out a set of disc brakes versus the standard brakes that may tie a mechanic up for a day and a half. So in a fleet as large as ours, to get the rig back in service, basically while the company waits around for a brake job, is a huge asset versus stripping the truck down, sending it to the repair shop, and generally it's tied up for 4 or 5 days. Not that it takes that long to do the brakes, but by the time it gets in line, they do the brakes and we get it back. So we have reduced our downtime and our maintenance time significantly by going to disc over drum brakes.
All right. Second part of the question that came in from George is that what type of retarder do you recommend for reliability, less strain on components, etc.? This again, great question. Three basic types of retarding devices that you can put on a piece of apparatus. They're required by the 1901 standard on anything that has a gross vehicle weight rating of greater than 35,000 pounds. So by today's standards, if you're bigger than a MIDI pumper, just about everything out there today has some type of engine retarding device. Most common one, or the least expensive, is some type of engine brake that can either be an exhaust brake or a compression brake that will operate on any one of the inline six-cylinder motors. And they typically will have costs, again, varying from manufacturer to manufacturer, in the area of about $2,300 to maybe $2,800 to put on as an upfront cost. They typically have, if it pretend is by brand, happens to be a Jacobs engine brake, which is used pretty commonly on units and with Detroit diesel engines, has a three-position switch on medium, and high. I happened to be at a station just the other day, and when you integrate the Jake brake properly with the automatic transmission, this has to be something that they have to do in with the controlling of the ECM, or the electronic control module. You can get the Jake to come on, but then actually work in conjunction with the transmission to downshift the transmission, because one of the issues that you normally had previously with the Jake brake is the Jake brake would cut out at about 850 to 900 RPM. So if you were envision this scenario, you're returning from a call, all right? You can see the traffic lights ahead are green, but they're about ready to cycle, so they're going to be turning to amber and then ultimately to red, and you're going to have to stop. In the past, if you let off the accelerator so that the Jacobs brake or the engine brake would begin to engage, once you got below that around 1,000 RPM limit, the transmission would kind of like glide or coast, and then you would have to get on the service brakes to be able to bring the unit to a complete stop. It can be set up now and integrated with the transmission to have the transmission downshift, and when used properly, even if you were running at 50, 55 miles an hour, you let up off the accelerator, the transmission will downshift. You can almost bring the vehicle to a complete stop without ever having to get on the service brakes.
Hey, can we have that interact with the anti-lock brake system?
Yeah, that also is integrated or interfaced with the anti-lock brakes, so that if you do go into a skid condition where before, again, old style, where you just had the manual switch, there was generally some type of little, going back, we're dating ourselves now, to a little dymo-lape table that would say, shut Jake brake off in wet weather, because they would previously would tend to turn the rig into a skid. With ABS, the Jacobs brake is interfaced with the ABS system, so it'll automatically shut off, and it's not something you have to do yourself while operating the vehicle. Next up is a transmission retarder. While there are some other minor players in the market, obviously Allison, the Allison automatic, no matter which model you use, is pretty much the transmission du jour that we use in the fire service, and they offer an output retarder. That can be set up to operate in a couple of different ways. One of the more effective ways is for you to get a portion of the transmission retardation once you let up off the accelerator. And then you begin to get additional retardation up to 100% as you step and apply pressure on the service brakes to the point where you've got full pressure down on that. Many departments had tried output retarders when they first came out, or first became prevalent, late 80s into the 90s. And again, to say the first ones that came out were problematic was an understatement. Particularly out in the desert southwest, because of the high ambient heat temperatures, and I can personally attest to that. Back a couple weeks ago, I was coming back from a vacation trip from the Grand Canyon, and while driving through the city of Phoenix, Arizona, which operates a large fleet of mid-engine units that have the third type of retarder we're going to be talking about, of a Telma output retarder, it was 116 degrees. So if it's as hot as it might be when we take up here today and walk back to our hotels or go grab a bite to eat, at 116 degrees ambient, they couldn't cool the device enough, even by using an external cooler, to be able to keep the early versions of the transmission retarders cool. That has now since been improved to the point where the reliability of those is pretty good, and you're up in the area, again, depending on model of transmission and your GVW application, you're up in the area about $4,500 to maybe $5,500 to put that on the vehicle. Now, several departments have taken where they do a lot of running and have become pioneers with this. Fort Worth, Texas is one example that I can speak to. They have, on their last batches of pumpers, combined both a Jacobs engine brake and a transmission output retarder. According to the apparatus captain out there, Homer Robertson, who is just a wealth of information and was very, very helpful to me on my visit there. I want to say that the figures were previously with disc brakes and a Jake brake, they were getting just under about 10,000 mile interval in between brake jobs. Now, if we in a volunteer service, 10,000 miles is a couple years of use. In the city of Phoenix, the average engine company mileage is up around 28, 29,000 miles a year. In Fort Worth, it was like in the mid-20s. So if you're doing brakes at 8,000 to 10,000 miles, that rig's getting 2 to 2.5 brake jobs a year. You got a lot of downtime, which means you need to have a lot of spare rigs so that you can keep someone riding on the apparatus and delivering our service. They, in working with a couple of vendors and with Spartan Motors, which was the chassis of choice there for their last several batches of pumpers, combined disc brakes, a Jacobs engine brake, and an output retarder, and I don't recall now which engine it was, but it was one of their high mileage units, and it was in for its first brake job, and it was like between, I think, 22 and 23,000 miles. It was pretty incredible. So in their mind, paying more money for getting what we would envision to be dual retarding devices was more than pay for itself in the life of the vehicle if they were going to keep the rig in 10 years. Now you're doing one brake job a year instead of 2.5. You're paying for it in the downtime and in the maintenance aspects.
And in the third, which is what my department went to, is electromagnet brakes or driveline retarders, and the company of choice for that is Telma. And we experienced the same things in the New York City fleet that Fort Worth did, not so much that we drive a lot of miles like a Fort Worth or a Phoenix, but just the downtime from brake jobs. When I first got on the apparatus committee, we were going through brakes at the rate of about 6,000 miles per set of brakes. And it was really a concerted effort by the vendors and the committee and everybody to try and turn this around. And we did several things. One is we did spend the extra money, and driveline retarder now, 13,000.
Yeah, I get a little bit less than that, probably around 10. And again, that's largely going to depend upon whether you got a single axle or tandem axle application. But if you go from least expensive is an engine or a compression brake, the middle of the road cost is going to be an output retarder on a transmission. The highest cost is going to be a Telma. And it's, again, going to be dependent upon how many runs you do and looking at the payout and the trade-off of paying a little bit more money up front versus the downtime and the attendant cost to re-brake the unit.
And that's where we were at that point in time. The city of New York, who's very careful with their budget money, believe you me, determined that it was better to spend $8,000 or $9,000 up front to reduce downtime and maintenance costs. Between putting the Telma retarder, the driveline retarder on, and there's no switches on and off for any of our rigs, those systems are interfaced with the anti-lock brake system, so that if the vehicle senses that it's going to be in a skid, the anti-lock brake computer, in milliseconds, it shuts the driveline retarder down. By doing that, by putting tandem axles on heavier ladder trucks and better weight distribution, putting disc brakes on, putting Telma retarders on, having them interfaced with the anti-lock brake computers, and then you'll notice some City of New York rigs actually have now aluminum wheels rather than the standard steel to help dissipate the heat away from the brakes. We were able to extend our brake life up to 18,000 miles by spending that money and doing those things on the front end. Again, less downtime, less maintenance costs. So people a lot smarter than us determined that it was better to spend the money up front and you would get great benefit on the back end as you own the vehicle for the 10 or 15 year lifespan.
All right, we're going to jump back up here on our list just to talk about pumps on trucks for a second. Now, we're not talking about Quints. Our rigs are going to be deployed or dispatched as Quints, but this is a great question. It came up in our class the other day from a brother firefighters out in Huntington, Long Island, that were looking to replace about a 22-year-old tower that had a pump. And a question came up at one of the breaks saying, you know, we've got a fairly good debate. We think we're going to replace the tower with the tower, but we want to know, you know, what are your thoughts, Tom and Mike, about putting a pump on a ladder truck? So here's a couple of thoughts, right? If your department is such that you only have like two engines and a truck and that's the whole fleet and it's a one station, or maybe you've got these rigs deployed in two different locations and that's the whole fleet, then maybe putting the pump on the ladder truck makes a little bit of sense to cover yourself in that you'd have a backup or essentially a reserve unit in the event that one of your other frontline engines went out of service. In this particular department, I want to think they told me they had 3 or 4 engines and the truck, and they were certainly located geographically in an area that if they needed additional engines, Yeah, they were coming from outside departments, but there were plenty of those resources around. Assuming that you have a tandem axle unit, when you put a pump on a ladder truck, you are typically taking the single largest volume space-wise, cubic foot-wise, area, dedicating that to the fire pump, where that could be used to either provide a large transverse compartment where you can put a lot of tools and equipment, would improve the ability to have longer ladders come in from the rear, understanding that because of the 1901 standard now, the ground ladder complement on a aerial ladder truck, if you don't ask and don't tell, you're getting 115 feet, including some ladders. To my way of thinking, one of the ladders the standard calls for is a two-section 24-foot ladder. I don't know why you would want to carry that on a ladder truck unless you've got a very low-rise district, because you've got one of those ladders showing up on every pumper. The ladder truck should be carrying ladders that you need that are kind of complement and be longer than what you've got in your other areas. The other consideration there is that putting the pump on there, in some cases, depending upon who the decision makers in the group are going to be, to say, okay, well, let's just put a pump on the truck just to kind of cover ourselves, all right? Well, what do you think the next thing's going to happen? Somebody's going to say, well, we got to have a water tank now, all right, because if nothing else, you got to keep the pump wet, so now we got a couple hundred gallon water tank. Well, then the next thing you know, somebody's going to want to throw, because now you got the fire pump, let's throw a couple of cross lays on there. And I've actually had people tell me, we just have it on there to protect the vehicle, just in case the truck starts on fire, all right? Well, if you do all of those things, then the next thing is, and this is the engine company guy coming out of me, somebody says, we need to put supply line on the back. Well, now you put supply line in the back, that's impeding into the compartment space and into the area where you should have the ground ladders. Pretty soon, what do you got? Now you got a quint, you just don't run it that way, all right? We're fooling ourselves. And again, this is not what the manufacturer wants to build. This is all about what you need for your community and what's going to do the job. And going back to the gentleman, Tom, that wrote in from Gilderland, you know, saying, I'm concerned the decision's going to be made by opinion rather than facts. If you've got more than five people on your apparatus committee, you've got a lot of opinions. You might not have a lot of facts. And that's where things tend to sometimes go a little bit afoul.
And maybe you need to get help. If you're only buying one ladder truck every 30 years, you may want to get somebody like us, and there's plenty of people that have expertise with apparatus, to sit in with you, to act as kind of a broker between you and the salesman, understanding that some salesman that sits across from you may have been selling sewing machines last week, and now you are working on your once-in-a-career ladder truck that may have to last 30 years, and you may be plucking down $800,000 or $900,000 for that particular piece. The one time that somebody came up with a good answer to put a pump on a truck, said, well, why do you have the pump on a truck? We're coming up for our ISO rating, and to make our fire flow, we needed to have the pump on the truck because we didn't have enough engines. That, to me, kind of makes sense. Something that you can gain some kind of benefit out for your insurance ratepayers to keep your ISO rating where it is, or to perhaps lower it. Other than that, you have to wonder.
All right, we're going to take another question that came in, and this was a very well-written email. It wasn't necessarily in the form of a question, but brought out a couple of nice points that we just want to make our audience aware of. Chief Mark Kincaid from the Muskegon, Michigan Fire Department, just taking an excerpt from some of his commentary. If you are interested in buying a car, you can go to a newsstand and probably buy at least 10 magazines which will compare similar vehicles up head-to-head. This is what's missing in the fire service. We need a resource that will take a number of similar apparatus, put them to the test against each other, and include some long-term test data. Where Chief Kincaid was going here is that when he took over in his department, he was responsible for replacing his fleet of apparatus in a rather short duration of time because of some mechanical issues that they had with the current fleet. And not being someone who had a lot of experience in with the apparatus in particular, it's something that Mike and I see very frequently, is that it rests at the doorstep ultimately of the fire chief. If something goes wrong or doesn't work well, they say, well, chief, what are you going to do about this? Or in many jurisdictions, the chief may be technically an excellent fire ground commander. He may be, from a personnel management standpoint and a budget person, may be a home run. but may not be particularly mechanically inclined, yet their ultimately decision of what kind of apparatus they're going to buy and how they're going to do it and how they're going to deploy it all rests with that particular gentleman. Well, Chief Kincaid brought up some really good points, and something that Mike and I have kind of wrestled with for a while is saying, you know, wouldn't it be neat, but who could potentially underwrite the cost to come out with this ostensibly the consumer union or the consumer reports, not just the fire trucks, but of ground ladders, of nozzles, all right, of turnout gear, take a lot of the consumables of things that we use all of the time. While working the last couple of days down at the Anne Arundel County Training Academy, one of their engineers that was operating the Peace Force during their outside evolutions mentioned that some testing that Anne Arundel County did on their nozzles, that the vendor will go nameless here, but they had thought that they might have some issues over how much water they were flowing through these automatic nozzles that were purporting to flow in the area of between 50 to like 250 GPM. So when they did their annual in-service pumper test, they started, I guess, testing some nozzles and found out that there was over, I believe that the gentleman said, an over 60% failure rate of nozzles that had been out in the field for 5 to 10 years, and where, based on their hydraulic calculations and their pump pressures, thought that they were getting 150 to 170 GPM, they found some nozzles that were flowing less than 70 GPM. Well, that kind of puts the exclamation point on the sentence to make you understand why, A, there was a lot of fires that were probably burning past a one-line fire. They became two or three-line fires very rapidly. Why guys felt that they were going in there and thought they were putting a knock on the fire and didn't. Well, as a result of that, when they presented these issues to the nozzle manufacturer, apparently they weren't, you know, rectified to Anne Arundel County's, you know, the way they wanted to. They ended up changing every nozzle on every engine in every station for 35 firehouses. You know, I mean, you don't do that without having some just cause to go do that. Well, how neat would it be, just think about turnout gear, you know? If we're going to go out to go buy a shirt or buy a suit, you know, I mean, what do you do? I know what I do, a couple suits I got. Find a brand that you like, you know, try to get it fit up. The guy goes, man, you got an odd-shaped body here. We're going to have to really work on this, you know? And $80 worth of alterations later, you walk out there with something that you think you look good in. With turnout gear or nozzles or many of these components, things that we're literally, relying our life on, it would be nice to have that independent test agency out there to do that. Now, taking that one step further with fire apparatus would be pretty difficult to do that, because you could take a, even though they are purchased from the same vendor, take a New York City pumper, and then at the other end of the country, take a LA City pumper. Both built by the same people, have the same brand pumps, but boy, they sure operate differently, and even to a novice, you walk around them, they look a lot different. So one of the things that we're going to try to do in the future is maybe at least highlight some positive results by taking examples, whether the department is small or large, career or volunteer, but somebody, as I call it, that had a success story. They had a particular issue, and it doesn't make any difference who they bought the rig from, but we're going to go through and we're going to be describing their process, some of the hurdles that they had to overcome, and their level of happiness is a result of the fact that they're running the vehicle today and they're operating it successfully. So we thank Chief Kincaid for his comments and review. You know, maybe at some point, I don't know that it'll be in our lifetime, that there would be somebody to come along in the fire service to realize that as a consumer organization, we buy a lot of stuff. You know, unfortunately, 5,500 fire trucks in North America pales by comparison to even the number of trucks in the commercial truck market, much less how Consumer Reports go independently and go buy. In the most recent issue, they did a Toyota, a Honda, a Buick, and three other things. They went out and they bought six cars and compared them up head to head. You know, who out there would want to go fund us to say, we're going to go buy a P, a K, a S, an A, and a some, you know, five other, you know, fairly standard Class A pumpers at $250K a shot, and then we're going to go have somebody go independently go test them. The funding mechanism you'd have to have for that would be pretty significant, I'm sure.